And just so everybody knows, there is no big illustration today. So just yet. At least not my illustration. The northern kingdom of Israel fell to the power of Assyria. And we date that at 722 BC. Really, for about 20 years prior to that was a slow demise of the northern kingdom as Assyria would come in and do their raids and finally come in 722-ish and really take it completely over, taking over the city of Samaria and bringing the northern kingdom to an end. Now you would think that the southern kingdom of Judah, the southern kingdom of Israel, would have learned their lesson. You would have thought that they looked to the brothers to the north, truly fellow Hebrews, and see that through their lack of connection to Jehovah, their willful sin, their turning to idols and turning away from Jehovah, you would have thought that that would have been such an illustration that they would say, we dedicate ourselves to the glory of the only begotten, to God, to the one who is eternal. Problem is, even though Judah would last another 100 and so years, they didn't listen. They didn't learn. They had some good kings. The northern kingdom had, to our knowledge, no good kings. But even in the southern kingdom, you would have a spiritual revival for maybe a generation. And then often it would turn very, very quickly back towards sin. And God would send prophet after prophet, probably one of the most well-known, especially to the southern kingdom of Judah, is the prophet Jeremiah. I want to read to you from Jeremiah chapter 25. I want you to listen to this. If you have a Bible you want to follow along, that's great. It says, the word that came to Jeremiah concerning all the people of Judah, in the fourth year of King Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah. That was the first year of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, which Jeremiah the prophet spoke to all the people of Judah and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem. For 23 years, from the 13th year of Josiah, the son of Amon, king of Judah, to this day, the word of the Lord has come to me, and I have spoken persistently to you, but you have not listened. You have neither listened nor inclined your ears to hear, although the Lord persistently sent to you all his servants, the prophets, saying, turn now, every one of you, from his evil way and evil deeds, and dwell upon the land that the Lord has given to you and to your fathers from old and forever. Do not go after other gods to serve and worship them or provoke me to anger with your work, with the work of your hands. Then I will do you no harm. Yet you have not listened to me, declares the Lord, that you might provoke me to anger with the work of your hands to your own harm. Therefore, thus says the Lord of hosts, because you have not obeyed my words, behold, I will send all the tribes of the north, declares the Lord. And for Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, I will bring them against this land and its inhabitants. And against all these surrounding nations, I will devote them to destruction. And I will make a horror, a hissing, an everlasting desolation. Wouldn't that at least get your attention? What Jeremiah now says after 20 some years of preaching to this southern kingdom, after other prophets begging them to repent, to change, to grow, to become what God wanted them to be. Jeremiah's word is God's done. And he will bring about not just a demise, but this hissing, this desolation. I mean, when you think back to it, I mean, what God promised to Abraham, that every place where his foot walked would become a land for his descendants. When you think about the relationship that God and David had, even King Saul at the very beginning, and even King Solomon at the very beginning, but especially God and David, and the kingdom that was set up through David, and the beauty of what David could bring, even in spite of his own personal sin. God's statement is, I'm done. I am done. So here's what is going to happen. I'm going to take these tribes from the north. I'm going to take King Nebuchadnezzar, who, interestingly, he calls a servant, as in he is using him. Not that King Nebuchadnezzar loves God. That's not the issue here. And I am going to bring my wrath upon you. And it's again one of those things like Hezekiah or that Habakkuk would talk about. Why, God, would you use a more evil people to punish a less evil people? He's not even trying to say that they're not evil. They're just less evil than the enemy. God is now going to say through Jeremiah, I will destroy you. And I will destroy you for the reason that you have not honored me. I have given you every opportunity and I have taught you everything you need to know. You have chosen to not receive my teaching. You have chosen to not obey what the prophets have said. So it's by the work of your own hands that you were getting what is coming to you. This is on you. It's really not even on God. This is on you. I'm just going to make sure it gets done. For the months of October and November, I want to take some lessons from the book of Daniel. I am not going to be hitting every single chapter in Daniel. We're not going to be going through it verse by verse. We're going to take some highlights from the beginning through the end of the book of Daniel and talk about some lessons that we can learn from that. Our first lesson opens up as we open the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 1, and I have verses 3 through 7 on the screen. And I'm going to be reading it, but I'm going to start actually in verse 1, and then obviously 3 through 7 we'll pick up here. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, and some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Beginning now with verse 3. Then the king, that's Nebuchadnezzar, commanded Ashpenaz, the chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge and understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace, and to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food from the king, that the king ate, and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time they were to stand before the king. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar. Hananiah he called Shadrach. Mishael he called Meshach. And Azariah he called Abednego. I want you to understand a few, I'm going to take two basic main points from this section. And the first point is Nebuchadnezzar's indoctrination. Nebuchadnezzar came to Jerusalem. He had been besieging the southern kingdom and raiding it, and so did other tribes. But Nebuchadnezzar's army finally came in and got to the capital city of Jerusalem, besieged it. And even though they set up a puppet king there for a little while, they began the process of taking the captives. I'll tell you another word. They enslaved the people. And so they would take from those people their captives. And they would take from the nobility, they would take from the royal family, they would take from them. Nebuchadnezzar wanted to take the youth. He wanted to change things, and his desire or his understanding was, if I can change the youth, I will destroy everything else. Once I get them, I get the nation. And his method was pretty straightforward in our passage. The very first thing he says to his chief of eunuchs, when he says, go out and get these guys, he says, I want you to take the best of the young people who are able to become what he wanted them to become and place them in a comfortable place and take care of their needs. Take the best of the youth. Now, as we read, we're going to use one Hebrew name and three Chaldean names, Daniel, then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, because those are the names we're most familiar with. Those four people become central to this book and to these opening chapters. But I want you to understand something. They are not the only four people. In fact, there's indication that there were others, and not just from Judah that came, but from other nations that had been conquered. So he says to the chief eunuch, he says, I want you to take these young people, take the best of them. How old was Daniel and his friends when the book of Daniel begins? We don't know. We get indicators that they are young. Okay? And many commentaries will give you an age range, and that's probably the best that you can do. I've seen it as young as 12 or 13. I've seen it as old as 17, 18, 19. But whatever that age would have been, these youth, I want you to understand, we're talking Faith, Lauren, and Evan's age. Okay? I just want that to sit with you. Now that I've embarrassed the three of them, I want that to sit with you. Okay. What is your expectation of Faith, Lauren, and Evan? And I'm not going to ask you to go have a sit-down conversation with the three of them. But could you imagine what it would have been like for that age group to have been forcibly removed from their family, from all that they have known, from what little upbringing they have had, just because they are younger people, so it's been lesser of amount of time. Okay. And then when people are being led away, literally with rings through their noses, you get a group like this that suddenly is thrust really into the lap of luxury. Now, they may have come from the lap of luxury also. Nobility, royal family. But they would have witnessed a devastation, maybe of their parents or of other people, and watched them being literally chained and taken away. And now they have been brought and placed into this environment with nothing but the best around them. That was the first thing he did. Take those best, young, brightest minds and bring them to where you can meet all of their needs. The second thing he does is he asks them, or he says to his chief of the eunuchs, he says, have them read and study all the great works and teach them the language of the Chaldeans. So here are these young people that have been taken away from their homeland, taken away from their family, taken away from the adults that have given them any type of supervision, good, bad, or indifferent, taken away from all of that. They're placed now in this environment with other really brilliant young people. And then set before them all that human knowledge could give. I mean, Babylon was not some podunk little tribe. Okay? I mean, Assyria fell, and it fell to Babylon. Egypt, this great and powerful nation for centuries, millennia, could no longer stand against Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was, you might hate him, but was a brilliant mind. So he takes these young people and he then indoctrinates them through both a change of a language and giving them all the literature. So instead of speaking Hebrew, they are now speaking the Chaldean language. The third thing he does is he blesses them literally with food fit for a king. Okay? This is, take the food and the wine from the king's table and give it to these young people. These are the best and brightest. These are the people that have been given every opportunity to grow, to learn, to become. And even their physical needs are met. I mean, met in a way that is truly as sumptuous as the food that the king himself would eat. Now keep in mind, if they had any opportunity to see anybody from Judea, I say guarantee, but I would at least guess those people didn't have near what these young people had. And they're seeing the stark contrast now. The defeated nation trying to get by and survive. And them being, for the most part, loved by what seems to be a benevolent king. And then he does the fourth thing, which changes everything. He gives them a new name. He takes their Hebrew name. He takes the name that mom and dad gave to them. And it's really interesting, and I don't remember and I didn't write it down, but if you take a look at each of their Hebrew names and what they mean, it centers around God for the most part. And he gives them a new name, a Chaldean name, that centers around the Chaldean gods. Their names are changed, and the God of their name is changed. So now they're being called by a name that blesses some foreign idol or foreign god. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are all connected to Chaldean gods. And even Belteshazzar is connected to a foreign god. So he changes their name. He literally indoctrinates. And maybe that's a nice way of saying brainwashes the youth. I will change the youth and I will recreate them in my image. And when I have them, I've got everything else. The parents, people, the adults, we're going to enslave those people. We're going to capture them. We're going to treat them to our benefit. They will become our workers. Their children, we're going to raise up to become Chaldeans, not Hebrews. You know, this isn't the first time that has happened, a situation like this. There's another time, one that is very well known to all of us, probably here anyway, and that is the very beginning of the book of Exodus, really Exodus chapter 2, where these parents, godly people, Levites, from the tribe of Levi, have a little baby boy at a time when the little baby boys were to be killed. And they do their best to take care of that little baby boy. But it becomes obvious that they cannot. Not that they can't take care of him, but that he will become found out. It would be hard enough to lose that child immediately. But to have that child just even for a few months, maybe even a few years, and then that child gets taken away again, oh, that would be heartbreaking. The mother does the strangest thing. She makes a basket, pitches it with a tar, a sap, and has her daughter take that little baby, put him inside of that basket, and places him in the Nile River. Now, that may sound really strange to you, and I don't know that I can. I'm going to give you a Jeffrey belief. I think where the princess went to bathe was known. And I think the mother's belief, this is a Jeffrey opinion, if I get this child out there, that girl cannot see a baby and kill it. That's just my opinion of why it happened that way. Maybe I'm naive. But the little girl takes that boy and it gives him a new name. She names him Moses, for she drew him out of the water. It wasn't a Hebrew name. She gives him an Egyptian name. She takes him back to the palace after he is weaned from his mother, who she didn't really even know was his mother, and raises him and gives him the best of everything, the best of education. Moses had access to everything at that time, and Egypt was a powerful nation at that time. He lived in the lap of luxury. He grew up with all that Pharaoh could offer him. But like Moses, Daniel, and then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, which I know are their Chaldean names, did not fall for this indoctrination. The Bible describes Daniel and his friends as without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understanding, and qualified to serve. I know it sounds like a description of me, but we're talking about Daniel here. And his point was to take the cream of the crop and say, I will recreate them. For Daniel and his friends, they really couldn't have had an easier life of enslaved people than what they had. I'm not saying it was perfect. I'm not saying it was easy. I'm not saying they didn't go through pain. I'm not saying life was the same. I'm just saying it was much better than what it could have been for others. They were to serve the king's court, a place of great power and even influence. It was a great opportunity. But there is a snag. Daniel was being asked to fit in, to become something that he was not. Do you conform to this world, or do you stand your ground? That is the choice that Daniel and his three friends would have to make. If you continue on in Daniel, let's take a look at chapter 1, verse 8. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. I would love to know Daniel's age. I know from Jeremiah that he says it's going to be a 70-year exile. And I know from history that we're going to go through a series of some kings and even a changeover of who is in power with the Medo-Persian Empire coming over the Babylonian Empire at the end and Cyrus becoming king. So I know we've got at least a 70-year span in the covering of this book, probably a 70-plus year span. But even if you put the guy at 15, I'm just throwing out a number because I'm terrible with mathematics, and you add 70 to it, he's 85 at the end of the book. I think we often think he's still 17 or 15 or whatever when the book comes to an end. He's an old man by the time it comes to an end. Okay. And what we're going to see as we go through this is how Daniel can stay so strong and stand his spiritual ground when being asked to conform to that which is around him is the constant struggle, or at least the constant temptation. Daniel says he doesn't want to eat the food or drink the wine, and he uses the phrase because it would defile him. There is nothing in Levitical teaching that would say eating of meat was wrong in and of itself. There would be types of meat, there would be the way the meat was prepared, there would be some of that that could be wrong. But his point was, whatever was going on, and maybe he was at a point where he said, I don't know how things are done. But the bottom line is, in Daniel's mind, is if I eat of that, I defile me and who I am. And so he goes to the chief eunuch, and God has been with him through all of this, which, interestingly enough, at this point in time in Daniel's life, he has seen zero miracles to our understanding. The only thing he has seen is God's wrath. Okay? God didn't pull him out of exile. I mean, he's in exile. But he says, here's who I am. And I don't want to do this because that defiles who I am. He was so confident in his own self and in the God that he loved, that he was not willing to do anything that would change that. And they worked so hard to change him. And he says, no, please don't make me have to do this. God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief eunuch. And so the eunuch says, fine. You don't have to. Look what happens. We're going to begin with verse 11. Then Daniel said to the steward whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of youths who eat the king's food be observed by you. And deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh. I got that one down. And then all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables. Now, I think 10 days seems to be a short period of time. Can 10 mean something more than a strict number of days? Doesn't really make a difference. There's a period of time, we're going to say 10 days, in which Daniel says, here, let's just play a test. You let me and my friends eat what we believe is good for us. And you let everybody else eat from the king's table and drink the king's wine. And at the end of the time, just take a look at us. And then you can determine whether what we're asking you is still going to be good for you. Because I'll tell you, the chief servant of the eunuchs didn't want to do this. Because and I'm not trying to make light of this. His head is at stake here. Okay? This guy is probably enslaved himself. This guy's job is to make sure these young people turn out the way they're supposed to. And if he fails, Nebuchadnezzar doesn't seem to have a problem with killing somebody. So he really doesn't want to do this. But God had been so gracious, even though Daniel doesn't know this is God that's going on behind the scenes, that the chief eunuch says, okay, we'll do it. And then after 10 days, they are compared, and there is a difference. There is a difference between them. How he sees that difference, how did God open his eyes to see that difference? I don't know. Is it all physical? Is it all just God opening the eyes of the person to see? But the challenge that was set before Daniel and his friends is relatively simple. Do you conform or do you stand your ground? If I was going to say there's two lessons for me to choose from in this opening book of Daniel, the first lesson would be, if you want to change society, you change the kids. The second would be, all of us. Are you willing? Are you going to conform to this world or be transformed by the renewing of your mind? And that's a choice you're going to have to make. Who are you going to listen to? Who is it that you're going to follow? Daniel chose, and his friends chose, to continue to listen to what they believed was going to be God. They were set before the king's service and he was amazed with them. But the king that they would serve really was not Nebuchadnezzar. The king that they would serve, as we'll take a look at their stories as we go through the book of Daniel, the king that they would serve is Jehovah, Yahweh, their God. The God that you and I would serve. The Lord did not miraculously free Daniel and take him out of Babylon and place him somewhere else of safety. William Barclay wrote an old commentary, and he wrote lots of commentaries in several little books. And in one of his little books called The Apostles' Creed, he makes the statement. He said, Jesus did not say, discuss me. He said, follow me. And as I read that, and there's much more to the quote, but as I read that from Barclay, I thought, isn't that so true? I mean, so many times as Christians, let's just sit down and talk about this one. We'll put it in committee and we'll make some decision and we'll see what everybody has to say. Barclay says, Jesus didn't say, discuss me. He said, follow me. What does it mean to follow Jesus? Well, Jesus' own words were, deny yourself, take up your cross daily, and follow me. That were his words. Christianity is not just simply about being interested in Jesus. There's a lot of people that get interested in Jesus. Christianity is about becoming servant of Jesus. It is giving your life over to Christ. And Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would face that multiple times during that 70 years that they were in, and they may have lived all of the rest of their life in Babylon. So let me ask, how about you? Will you be Daniel to this generation? Will you be Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to this congregation? Will you be these young men who don't conform but stand firm to God in a world that absolutely does not conform to Jesus Christ? Are you willing to stand up and be who you are in Christ? That's the calling. And that's how Daniel begins. If we can pray for you or strengthen you in your journey, won't you come as we stand and sing?